fabulous guy. I met him in Hawaii in 1999 at the Alchemical Arts Conference, where he was a presenter, and I was just attending to see all the great presenters. And what struck me the most about him is his claim that he has two nervous systems. So maybe he'll tell you about that a little bit, but anyway, Bruce Donald.
My dentist says I must have two nervous systems as he shoots me up to try to get me numb, and then it all goes. So don't wish it on yourself. What I'm going to do, and this is going to take approximately 33 minutes, my time for this morning, 33-minute journey, where we're going to start with, and don't hold me to that, you can start throwing the cream pies 34 minutes. we're going to kind of do a journey starting with Terence McKenna, because I know he keeps getting mentioned here, and we just did a series of lectures at Burning Man called Palenque Norte, which is the second year that it's been there, and you know, there in honor of Palenque and honor of Terence. We're going to kind of go from Terence, and then we're going to go way out into the cosmos, and we may find him there, and then we're going to kind of try to come back. And so it's quite a journey. I'm sorry it's the end of the day. I hope there's some caffeine molecules in some of the brains out there that need it. Terence, as you may know, died in the year 2000. I was at Terence's house in April of 1999 when he looked terrible. We did a project with him where we built, his son Finn McKenna and several other people built a virtual world in cyberspace, and he went into this world and people came in as avatars, as little characters, and then he did a talk. About 30 people showed up, and he said, you know, I usually travel in a jumbo jet for 6 hours to talk to an audience of 30 people. So in the comfort of his home, there he was doing this, and people wrote trip reports. He was fascinated by virtual worlds and shared online spaces. But one of the things that's interesting is his mind contained such visions that he described, that he said, can these worlds be done? The visions that, one of the visions he described was one of dancing Fabergé eggs. I think you've probably heard of dancing silvery Fabergé eggs. And I said, Terence, I don't think we're going to get there for a long time in computer rendering. But, you know, we'll have to have hope. And he said, well, the good thing about this stuff is it's not scheduled yet. So I think, yeah, there's a multi-billion dollar, massive multiplayer gaming industry out there. It's not scheduled. Anyway, so at Alchemical Arts, which is a profound conference because it was the last conference Terence was able to attend because he, in May, he started having seizures. In April, he told us, we were staying with him, he said, I'm having dreams that I cannot explain. Now, from anybody else in the world, you'd think, well, you know, you have dreams, but not for Terence. You know, Terence really knew the landscape of all things big that could come into his mind, and he just couldn't understand these things. And he started suffering seizures in May. Went for a scan, the doctor came into his room and said, this will seem very ironic to you, but you have a tumor, a very large one, the shape of a mushroom. And Terence said, this is very ironic. This tumor is the shape of a mushroom, but he had less than about 10 months to live. So we held this conference, and at one point, I don't know who suggested this, but Terence lay down on the floor in sort of a circular room, and we all lay down with our heads pointing toward Terence to try to conjure up any vision that came to us. Some people wanted to try to heal him. I think it was, by this point, his literally the physical matter of his brain was dissolving, and the man was dissolving. He was very cognizant to the last moment, but he was kind of coming apart. And the vision that conjured into my brain was this sort of Fabergé egg on the side with shining polygons with their sort of little cushions in there, and there was Terence, and it was going up, and it was carrying him away. And I told him later about this, and somebody said, that was like Terence's getaway car. Anyway. Sort of seriousness aside, he was in Marin County for the last few weeks of his life, people always attending to him, and then when he was really a couple of days from death, having trouble breathing, he one of the things that came over him, suddenly he sat like a romantic poet in the four-poster bed, he sat bolt upright in bed, and he said, "It's all about love." Now, you probably do this all the time, but understand, Terence was a serious forebrain case, head case. It was all, for him, it was all about words. Words, visions, and pictures, and, you know, weaving words together. He's a bard of words. And he turned to somebody and said, "You know, I've never really been a love bug. But it strikes me now," or because in a sense, the great powerful forebrain of this man was dissolving, and what was coming up into that was this overwhelming sense of love as he was approaching death. He said, "The whole psychedelic movement, it's about love. It's not about all this other stuff. It's about love." You know, it was pouring through him. And 2 days later, he was just sort of in bed, just, you know, very, very little of him left. And he said, just before he died, he said, "Now I could have got this wrong, but he said, people keep on breathing, just keep on breathing." And that was the last of Terence McKenna. So from there, in trips that I've had come to sort of that same realization in heroic ghost trips, which I haven't done many of because you don't try to do that. If you come down to the thing, if you have some kind of an experience where you dissolve, where you're gone, how many people felt like they're almost gone? Like, now those kind of trips tend to strip away, they blow away stuff. I mean, and you come out of the bad phase or the good phase, you might call it, there's like nothing left. There's this little shaking thing that's just you that survived that, and it comes into a new territory, and it's very open to things, because everything else has been blown away. And however method you use to get through that phase, is you're now open. And I did that once myself, and the words came, "All it needs is love." You know, the Beatles have told us this, but you know, the little being just wanted love. And so I started to think about the Fabergé eggs and love and things like that, and it struck me in the last few years that the overwhelming sense of powerful love is so big, it's almost bigger than a human being. It's bigger than you can make from inside. And maybe the dancing Fabergé eggs that Terence saw are so fantastical, and there's such a complete universe of these eggs. It was a civilization of dancing Fabergé eggs. That it's almost sort of inconceivable that the memories that Terence had in his life, in his day-to-day life, could add up to making this self-consistent universe he saw. So I pose the question, does this stuff come from inside our bodies, from the complexity of our brains and our glial cells and whatever, it just may, does it come from somewhere else? Now, for millennia, people have thought, of course, there's an outside, there's an ether, there's a god, there's Mount Zeus, there's all these explanations for where these things come from. But we're in a remarkable era, an era of opening of understanding in cosmology that I think is so big. When you start to read, if you wade through Scientific American or Discover or whatever, and you read these articles and you start putting together, your mind starts to just like, oh my God, and this picture's emerging. And of course, everyone's working in their specialty, but if you read this stuff, it almost creates a sense of wonder. Every time you start reading, it's like, oh my God, it's almost a trip comes on, because the picture that's emerging of the whole universe and maybe how it began and maybe how it's going to end is dumbstrucking. And so what I want to do is to kind of try and give you a real short summary of that picture, because it is an awestrucking kind of a thing. And then maybe try to cast us out far into the future, maybe to the point of the death of the universe, because the universe, it seems, has a life cycle, just like you, just like a plant or a bird or in a sense, a single star. The universe has a birth, a life, and a death. And maybe it would suggest where some of this stuff, this big stuff, comes from. Maybe it comes from somewhere pretty remarkable. So it seems as though the universe is a sort of self-contained thing, never loses any information. If you look out into the night sky, you're looking back billions of years in some cases, and everything's still there. I mean, the signals are very faint, but they're looking back to periods of the formation of the first stars now. They're looking back to the cosmic background radiation, which was formed, you know, at the point of the inflationary Big Bang. They're sort of seeing, kind of like, oh, it's all there. The whole movie's recorded. There's nothing that's being lost. There's nothing dribbled over the edge and is lost. There's no files been deleted. Well, sorry for you security people. It's all there. It seems as though there's a Professor Arnold Guth that has proposed that if you add up all the stuff, all the dark matter and the energy and the positive and negative energy and whatever, you add it all, it comes to zero, adds to zero, sums completely to zero. So it's actually, the universe is nothing in total. Space keeps things apart, because if it was all in one spot, it would just split out of existence. There's nothing there. So space and change make the dynamism, but there really is nothing. Adds to nothing. And what's interesting about all this is that, how did the universe start? Well, Guth says, well, maybe it's a random quantum fluctuation in a field. So there was this happy time, the time of Eden, and it was just a quantum field. Everything was fluctuating properly, and then something didn't fluctuate properly, and it unpeeled into the entire universe. The potential energy is so big, a whole universe was formed. And maybe what's happening now is that this horrible pile of junk that appears is going to get cleaned up. So all these black holes are like, the mechanism saying, oh, we've got to get this mess cleaned up. And these black holes are sucking it all back in, and everything, sort of the vacuum cleaners have begun. Maybe that's the process. So if that's the case, is the universe a one-shot error that's eventually going to get cleaned up and it'll be back to the quantum the quantum field? Now, the universe could continue to expand at a faster and faster rate, as seems to be evidenced by what you can see. And therefore, things in the far future, galaxies will be so far apart you won't even be able to detect each other, and stars will be all brown dwarfs, and the stuff will just be going almost at the speed of light, and it will basically, matter and energy, the whole thing will evaporate into one big smear, of all gone. The other alternative is that there is enough of this dark, unknown matter to reverse that expansion and pull it back. Now, when it pulls back, of course, it's going to, that universe is moving and change. It's not just sort of sitting there. It's always moving. So it's either got to be expanding to a complete smear, or it's going to pull back. When it pulls back, it's going to collapse down. It's like if you were re-entering Earth's orbit or something that's crashing into the sun. It's being pulled back. And when it reaches that point, it, poof, it goes out of existence. And all the information, everything with it, so it'll be gone. It'll all add up to zero. So what if, indeed, in this whole process, if you look out at the universe, you probably could categorize all the stuff out there into two classes of stuff. Stars, they have birth, life, and death, but they're not living things in the way we define it. If you look back to the very first stars, they're the same as the stars we have now. Stars have not evolved. They've not created any new structure. They just sort of appear and they crush a bunch of gases together, and then they do something, and then they have a blast, and that'll blow the material off or to become a black hole. And rocks have been rocks for all time. Rocks haven't changed and evolved new structures. And then there's this funny little thing called life, which seems to go counter to all that, and it's the other classification of stuff. And it's, and where I had this epiphany about this was, I was down in South Africa in a gold mine about 600 feet down below the surface. And South Africans are, they're not, you wouldn't say they're risk averse, they're risk-seeking peoples. So they love to show off to tourists, so they have this great steam hammer, jackhammer, and there you are in this tunnel, stuff is dripping down, it's dark, and you're 600 feet down. Of course they've gone down for miles, and it's hot, and they're banging away on the side of the tunnel, chipping away some more gold, and saying, see, here's some gold, and it's oxidizing because there wasn't any oxygen in the atmosphere when this gold was laid down in a reef, just alluvial little bits and pieces. And you're in there, and you're shaking, and the beams are shaking, and you're thinking, this whole thing's going to come down and crush my body. And the gold reef, which was mined for a century, created great wealth in southern Africa, is 2 billion years old. No oxygen in the atmosphere 2 billion years ago, not enough for you. And I had this sort of epiphany that So what? The mountain can come down, crush my bloody little body. You know, just there'd be no remnant of it left. But I tell you, the DNA in my cells is tougher and more persistent than this gold reef, Africa, most star systems, i.e., for 3 point some billion years, there's little sequences of information that have been coded. They're coded in every cell in your body that had unchanged. They go back and march back billions of years. A mechanism called life was able to fight against all this crud and entropy and fires and brimstone and preserve this little piece of information forward, and that's called reproduction, it's called life. And that process is tougher, it outlives it's the life of most stars. It's certainly older and tougher and more resilient than all the configurations of the continents. So in the middle of this great machine that's the universe, if you could think of it as a machine, you have this tiny process that fights against the odds and wins in the universal game to a point. So what if, I'll digress for a moment. The whole thing is a digression. There's a fellow named Chris Langton, and many of you may know him. He started the artificial life field research. He started that field because one day, I think he fell out of a hang glider. He told me he was in a coma for 2 months. And this guy has broken almost every bone in his body before that. He likes to work with concrete, things like this. He built tree houses. And he told me that in the second month, as he started to come out of the coma, he started to sense his consciousness rebooting, coming back. And he said, it was like phases. There was one bit, and then another bit, and another bit, and I started to know I had a body, and then I rebooted. And I realized my consciousness was built out of emergent bits that just came together and started talking to each other, and another one was talking, and heard. And I said to Chris, well, what was the thing that was watching and feeling yourself rebooting? Was it sort of outside of you? And it was a curious idea. But it led to the idea that what if the universe, as this great big mass of stuff, has managed to create little bits of life here and there? Some of them go beyond the bacterial level and become more complex. Some of them start to look out at the universe and become aware of it, and maybe even communicate with other chunks of life here and there. What if the universe, like Chris Langton's brain, is gradually booting up an awareness of itself? Now, why would it do this? Well, every living thing seems to be, you know, we have pigs, and when we had them anesthetized to get their tusks cut off, it was a horrible thing when they came out of anesthetic, because a pig is an animal that wants to be on its feet at all times. If it can't stand up, it's going to bash its head against hundreds of times against every surface known, unless you can get to it and sit on it, because it's trying to come back to consciousness, and it knows what the right state for a pig should be, and it's going to go crazy until it can be in the right state, which is on all fours. And so watching the pig's emergent consciousness come back is a frightening thing. I mean, you want to run out of the pen. I mean, you're going to get killed. It's just a terrible thing. So in a sense, the universe is coming to consciousness. There's a certain urgency. Now, what is that urgency? Just like any living thing, it's its own life. It wants to be alive. It wants to know itself, but it wants to survive. Well, what is the doom? What is its doom? Well, its doom probably is the collapse. So, in a sense, is the universe trying to boot itself into consciousness before it collapses back down? Now, consider, when you're a little blastule, when your egg has had the sperm and it's starting to duplicate and replicate, little ball forms of cells, and it gets to a certain size, and a researcher friend of mine has written a giant tome about observing sonic waves going back and forth across this embryo. And they're very complex, and they're studying them. Because, of course, the key question in the embryo is, what starts cell differentiation? Why does the whole thing start turning into a cup, and then you get your gut on the inside and your outside on the outside? What restarts that? And it seems, he claims, that there's complex sonic waves. Well, in the birth of the universe, up to a certain period, the universe was a gas, and massive sound waves were reverberating across the universe, and they were creating the structure of sheet walls of galaxies and everything you see, and you can see that structure from satellites launched recently like WMAP. So at a certain point, just like in an embryo, the universe was a giant voice. And then it went silent. All the parts separated. There was no way to get sound waves across. Of course, we live in a gas ball too. Is it a coincidence that having a gas or a liquid as a medium for resonant communication seems to be present to make structure? That's one idea. So consider, if the universe is going into its collapse phase, it's coming back down, what is happening? Maybe the largest engineering project undertaken in the universe, which is the sentient beings, the percentage of the universe which is actually organized into life is increasing. It's up to 0.5% or something like, which would be enormous. It's up to 0.5%, and this collapse is occurring. There's a couple 100,000 years left. What has to happen? Well, the sentient races are actually now quite physically close. Indeed, the period at which the universe will be again in a gas is coming, where the entire thing is going to be connected sonically again. Well, if the universe has managed to convert a percentage of itself into an aware stratum, those beings, of course, have to make a decision. Do we work together as a team because we know the inevitable? Or do we carry on what we've always been doing, as we do on this planet, fight with each other, argue over budget and allocations and resources and culture and difference? Or do we try to save the whole thing? Can you picture in some future universe entering the gas phase and there's this glowing cloud, and the glowing cloud is getting brighter and brighter because it's actually the ignition of the sentience. And what are they doing? To do the engineering job of saving the universe from final annihilation, they have to do something pretty unusual. They have to sacrifice themselves completely. All those civilizations, all that history, all those beings have to give themselves over and dissolve themselves, like Terence's brain dissolving, to create a single entity. A single entity that can live and exist long enough in this collapsing universe to figure it out. So, a baby is born. An ignition happens. The gas phase is there. There's enough there. And the whole universe is now a single conscious entity. Now, like any baby, you know, if you've had kids, they all think they're the universe, right? At the beginning, they're everything. They're the center of everything. There's nothing else. There's no other demands. So there would be a period, indeed, where this universe is actually this tremendous creation of love, because the only way it could be created is in complete love. Anything else, anything short, would create something not whole enough to do this job. So this baby is created and born in love. And the baby has many abilities. The baby must start feeding, like any baby. This baby feeds on knowledge. And where's the knowledge? It's totally contained within the collapsing universe. The universe didn't lose anything. It's able to look back at you sitting here, look back at everything and try to figure out where its family is, where did it come from, and why is it here? Why is it created? And it has little time. And like any sentient species, things are left to the damn last minute. So the whole project was delivered at the last minute. So the baby is figured out, ooh, I'm getting really comfortable because I'm getting smaller and smaller. And ooh, bad news. I'm about to be doomed. The great crime of all of this is the oneness was established that we all seek. We all seek to be part of it, and it's about to be extinguished. The baby has to use every deductive power. It has to call back through time for every piece of support it can get to figure out how to save everything. Now, why would it save everything? Why wouldn't it just say, that's fine, it was a great life, let's just go. Well, it's the prerogative of life. It's going to make that decision to preserve the investment, to preserve the legacy, to go on, just have a future. So the baby works it out. The baby sees physics and sees how it can do this job. And what does it do? It starts to turn its body. It has all the resources at its beck and call. Every molecule, every wave of energy it can muster. As this collapse occurs, it starts to turn like almost like a dancer or a skater, because it knows from having worked out everything that if it turns fast enough, it can kind of pull itself apart and pull the big blob, which is about to collapse, into two blobs. So a gigantic cell mitosis happens. Two blobs, two bits of what was once one being, are now rotating like this. It's not the end of the story, because those two pieces are so big that they're going to implode into in violent way and destroy most of what was there. So those two pieces have to mitose, and again, and again, and again, until you have the safe level of the blastula that forms in every living being, including that made you. That ball forms, where each component is, can stand alone and can survive on its own. So where would that, where would the universe two, that's the second phase of the universe, what is it? It's now a colony, it's now a society, complete consciousness. But it has lost the one thing that had always been dreamed of, which was total unity. It's now a community again. And now has to work with all those things that communities do, including aloneness for the individuals. So where that second phase, that second life of the universe, should it achieve it, who knows where it goes? Does it try to figure out how to change, make another quantum wiggle? It's hard to know. Now trying to bring this back to Earth a little bit. So in a sense, one of the weird things about all this, the new work on string theory and other things, is you might think, well, that's a remote event. You know, it's like the great quake, you know, we won't think about it and it's way out. Well, in some interpretations of string theory, we're kind of living along several string dimensions which resonate in a certain way, but there's so many dimensions that in fact, all events that happened in the past and happen in the future are happening at once. What you're living in is a mesh. And it's kind of like a mesh that comes out, you know, you see big bang, big crunch, or something like this. This is one of the pictures drawn. Then in fact, you're inside the resonance of things that are happening at the same time. Everything's happening at once. So in fact, the event of the formation of that being, and that being's looking back, is happening all the time. You're just getting little crack visions of that, little gaps where that comes through every once in a while. And that the power that you feel when love comes through you, or when you see something and you have a vision that seems to be completely, you know, really out of this world, could it be coming from that future present event that is occurring, that you're just tapping into, that you're just opening a little door to? It's a question. Could that be that where that is coming from? And are you part of it? That great project the universe is trying to do, which is to know itself and to then save itself, and the only way is through love. And would somebody like Jesus Christ have been a human being that just happened to be born with an open valve, or maybe Buddha or Muhammad, an open valve to that massive form out there or in there that is this universal love? And that as a human being, they didn't kind of shut it off. They didn't kind of like, you know, do the shutdown and, oh, gee, that's too powerful, I'm scared about that. They just simply, they couldn't help themselves, it just came out, I mean, blasting out. And that's the way they live. They're tied into that all the time. It's a question. So in a sense, Terrence having and we talked about autism, and we talked about shutting down parts of the brain to see other, to have other things emerge. You know, as Terrence's brain dissolved, literally physically dissolved, what came rushing up through him was this tremendously powerful feeling about love that he could hardly, barely communicate. And maybe Terrence's leaving us allowed him to melt into that space, into that project, to join that project. So maybe that while he was here, like all people who create communication with resonant voice or make music and create a resonant vibration with other humans through love, they're part of maybe that great project. And maybe Terrence melted into that project or was taken back into that project, because he did have, that did come to him in the end. So I kind of went off my little schedule here. one of the last points is kind of a strange one, is that in your, why did the universe create human beings? And, you know, we talked about the joke about the brains for sale in India outside of hospitals. And the Pakistani ones were the ones that were more expensive because they're never used. It's not a kind thing for Pakistanis, but this human brain, and we talk a lot about the brain, I have been told that there are more discrete pathways through the brain than there are countable particles in the universe down to the quantum level. So the numbers are very big, and this thing, this jelly, gray jelly mass that's been created into us. So the universe has actually created a machine or a mechanism that can contain something that's a substantial portion of the vision of the whole universe. And that maybe that's part of, you know, from the single cell, that's part of the drive, is to create a machine that is able to be large enough that it can look out into the cosmos and start by bits and pieces and fits and starts to put together the whole picture. And, you know, John Wheeler, the physicist and contemporary of Dick Feynman, says, perhaps the universe is something that's created observers in order to then create the reality of itself. That the observation and the reality goes step by step, so that if you get observers emerging, more structure emerges in the universe at the same time. So maybe your brain, you've got two things going for you. Your brain is maybe big enough to get a rendering of a fraction of the universe, the whole thing, to accept, not burn out like Johnny Mnemonic, but accept visions and things that are large enough, sort of in a sense like a camera obscura. You can see the little fragments, and they're actually, your brain's big enough to carry those fragments that are very large. And the second thing is that you, through DNA and through the graciousness of our sun being so stable and not going through any dangerous parts of the galaxy for the last 4 billion years, your DNA have allowed you to go back 4 billion years and to journey around 65 times around the galaxy, etc. And that you've survived and given this incredible legacy of stability to evolve to this point so that you can be a camera obscura on something. And because you're here at this conference, what you're seeking is a connection with some greater thing. I mean, you take psychotropic to tap into that. Well, maybe you're part of a great project that is unfolding as we speak, and that you're citizens of. I know it's a wacky idea, but I, in a sense, after reading all this cosmology stuff, I kind of tend to want to believe that more than sort of traditional religious explanations, because my goodness, the people who looked at the night sky and followed leaders in white garb and whatnot didn't have this knowledge, and if they did, it'd blown their minds. They would have said, "Oh my, we'll create an even bigger vision for human spirituality if we had that knowledge." And some of them had that knowledge tacitly. Some of the indigenous peoples did have a more profound knowledge of where we are in the universe, and we give them credit for it. So, anyway, so I hope that that's, you know, and I think Terrence is out there. So if you want to reach him, I think you can reach him through love at this point, as his last message, and keep breathing. So thank you.